This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Producer Pete and me, John Williams. We're here with Tom Gimbel, the job expert and the founder of LaSalle Network. Happy Election Day to you, Tom.
And the last day of the trade deadline in the NFL, John.
more importantly, hey, listen, I was in a meeting yesterday with one of our salespeople and a client, and he was using an app which would listen in on the conversation, maybe even watch it, and then summarize it back as an email to all of us, giving us notes, and also, you know, recognizing what small chat is and isn't important, and what is important, and then breaking it down in bullet points. This was an app using AI, and it seemed very useful because during these meetings, a lot of times we're taking notes, maybe not gathering or remembering everything as we do. I wonder what you think about that, Tom.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. And I've used them before myself, actually. And they actually have them, in addition for that, that'll do it for Zoom calls and video calls and do the summaries like that. So, I mean, you're basically entering a world from an analogous perspective, like having a stenographer in a meeting.
Yeah,
a deposition.
Yeah,
I think that there's positives and negatives to it. I think the positives are just the way you outlined it. Of we're all clear on what the meeting was. People go in and out when they're not talking of what they hear and remember. And this way, I think, in the immortal words of a past president, you don't misremember things and that type of stuff. But at the same time, it does kill you with the small chat, the side talk. You say something that's a little bit too colorful and it's in print now and it can't be forgotten. And it does take away a little bit of the personality of meetings as well.
I hadn't thought about that. This is the first time I've ever been in on one of those. It seems to me like in the HR world, the AI apps or applications for screening applicants or even hiring people is more what I've heard about. And I'm not sure I love that.
Well, I think it's on a lot of different levels and the amount of screening, but screening takes place on resumes and job candidates for a variety of reasons. If you take out automation and you have human beings screening, then I'll tell you exactly what it's like. It's an athletic event, and you either have real referees who make human mistakes, or you have computers. And there's no give and take on it, and it's very black and white, and that's it. And so when you're doing this for screening candidates, okay, so you have a human being doing it, and now you have their biases, and you have those issues. Or you have a computer, and it has no biases, and too many people are in or too many people are out, and it has no flexibility based on experience versus education or what have you. And when you get into having notes and transcripts of everything, you know, what does that not do? It doesn't take into account sarcasm. It doesn't take into account body language when things are said. There's a lot of challenges that technology, which I think is a positive. I don't want to come across as a caveman. I love technology. But there are some challenges that we face in using it in day-to-day life.
So maybe it's not ready for prime time. Are you today an advocate for using AI to screen, essentially interview applicants?
I am for partial usage. If you've got a huge company, take a Fortune 1000 company, and they need to hire hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and now with the technology advent of chatbots and the level of ability that they have to communicate with people and to get through it, that you can skip a couple layers of human being interaction just to get through the base level. There's a value add there. I do understand why it should be used.
You said if the human beings are doing it, then there's a bias built in from the human that's screening applicants or doing the interview. I think you want that bias because...
Okay, so you have somebody and it says that they went to a college that I've never heard of, so I'm not going to use them. I'm a Midwest company. I'm biased towards Big Ten. I'm not looking at anybody from the West Coast colleges. Or we don't like community colleges, so they spent their first 2 years, so they're out. I don't like the sounding of their name, so they're out. You know, at face value, you like it, but yeah, I can drill down and find a million things that are discriminatory in practice.
Yeah, well, fair enough. But I wonder if that then model is going to do that anyway. They're going to take Ivy League schools over some little Missouri Valley school. That kid never gets a chance. That kid gets in the door and they light up the room. And what do you know? There goes a good applicant that the computer would never appreciate.
And so who gets that kid?
Well, you don't in this scenario.
The small company. The small company does. And this is why America on this day is the greatest country in the world. Because we have innovation, we have entrepreneurs, we have small and medium-sized companies, we have people that leave big companies to hire small companies. And if you want an opportunity, you take a job, you take an entry-level role, you do something outside of your education, your skill set for what you want, and there's always an opportunity for somebody willing to work hard. I believe that.
That's Tom Gimbel, the job expert, the founder of LaSalle Network. I saw what you put on LinkedIn. We'll talk about that next week. It was a thoughtful list. My friend Steve Alexander sent it to me, and we'll talk to you next, let's say Wednesday. How does that sound?
And maybe the autobiography, John, next week will be Rise Above the Machines.
Not exactly sure what that means. Thank you, Tom. Philip Weiss joins us, the president of SciFarth at Work, here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this election day. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Good to be with you.
So who should we vote for president?
You know, that is a loaded question, but we should be thinking long and hard about who to vote for. And a lot of bosses out there are thinking not only about who they will cast the ballot for, but how they will deal with blowback or high emotions starting tomorrow morning. So it's interesting because we've been so hyper-focused on the election itself, a lot of companies are now realizing, wait, tomorrow morning people are going to come to work or maybe the day after or the day after, depending on where returns come in, either delighted or despondent. And as employers, you got to be thinking about that and prepared for it.
So what do you do?
Well, you know, it's been a really interesting few weeks talking to clients and companies. Because on the one hand, you want to know that employees have a safe haven. I mean, the wonderful thing about the U.S. workplace, John, is it is really, for want of a better term, neutral territory, a safe haven, a place where respect, unity, working towards a shared goal are the paramount and, in fact, the primary goals on a daily basis. So making sure people understand that at work they can expect to be supported no matter how they feel buffeted by the political tribulations of the outside world is really critical. And to that point, John, a lot of bosses are looking back at their core values, the principles that they've established to guide the workplace and its environment, because in those documents, you're going to see terms like unity, like shared purpose, like resilience. And in a number of cases, we've heard, John, from companies telling us, we've reminded people that those are our North Stars. And no matter how you feel tomorrow or a week from now at work, we're going to have your back.
I'm trying to think now. I haven't seen any political signage or clothing at this place where I work. I wonder if bosses should have been telling their staff, no political messaging on your hats or T-shirts. And the same will go for tomorrow, even though the election say is over. What is your thought about the before and after of wearing red or blue clothes?
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for keeping political slogans, buttons, hats, and clothing out of the workplace. And a lot of companies have dress codes that talk about all of that. It's interesting because you do, as an employer, want to double check if you adopt some kind of restrictions, because there's lines you don't want to cross. Employers are allowed to express themselves when it comes to working conditions or their desires. Let's say they want greater leave laws to protect them, and they talk or advertise that view in connection with a candidate, that could be protected under the law. So you do want to be at least checking with your employment lawyer, but at the same time, I think you're absolutely right. The less those messages and images bleed into the workplace, the less likely we're going to see upheaval, dissent, or conflict between employees.
Okay, but so some people are going to be happy, some people are going to be sad. You want to tamp down the end zone dancing maybe from one group and try not to patronize the other group too much, but help pick them up. I'm wondering, is it a group activity? Should you bring in ice cream? Should you have comfort food tomorrow? Cocktails? I mean, could you give me some specifics about things that should be done in the office that will be different tomorrow?
Yeah, so I think that's a really important question. Comfort food is something a lot of employers are bringing for tomorrow and the days to come. Encouraging and complimenting people who took their civic responsibility seriously and voted, irrespective of the candidate, is something that has become a real message from top-down leaders. And your point, John, about activities, collaborative endeavors, has been so valuable for many companies. So, for example, a healthcare company realized that people were a little bit on edge due to the election, and they noticed this weeks ago already. So some creative all-hands events where people sat down together and just talked about why they entered the field of healthcare in the first place. And people realized how much they had in common, how much that shared purpose drove their daily work. That really replaced a lot of that concern, apprehension, and ennui that people were feeling. And very quickly, another great example is a local marketing company where the leaders sponsored a fall-themed competition where people teamed up and developed their best hypothetical pumpkin and harvest food marketing campaign just for the purpose of working in groups. And while people felt uneasy outside of work, they looked forward to coming into work because that was a chance to rejoin their team, work creatively, and really have a very positive experience. And that took that company through election season till today with a very different environment than they might otherwise have experienced.
Give me 45 seconds on the concern that employers should have, especially maybe in small businesses, not to make their election preferences trickle from the top down.
Yeah, that's key. The best practice, and obviously some people stray from this, John, is really not to, as a leader, as a boss, as a manager, engage in political talk yourself, because people might feel you're trying to influence them. And in many cases, outside of work, political affiliations and views are something that need to be protected. Certainly, we can't take action against people who, based on their views. So you do want to keep the work, the talk, very focused in the workplace, and even redirecting others when they get a little too engaged in those conversations back to their work projects, back to their collaborative activities is so important. So prepping your managers so they stay clear of the topics themselves and redirect people away from them in a positive diplomatic way can pay tremendous dividends this week and in the weeks to come.
Seyfarth at Work is spelled S-E-Y-F-A-R-T-H, seyfarthatwork.com. Philip Weiss is the president there. Thanks, Philip. We'll talk again.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. I'm John Williams, and Dennis Rodkin is the residential real estate reporter at Crain's, chicagobusiness.com. And welcome back, Dennis. How have you been?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Really good. You walked through a little rain today.
Just a little. Yeah, it's not too bad.
Just a tangent. How critical is the weather on the day of a home showing, do you think, to the selling of that home? You know, it's like when you go to visit a college campus.
Yeah.
And your kid goes, well, I was going to go to Iowa, but the weather was lousy that day.
It was terrible. I would say if you're coming in from out of town looking at homes, it's probably hard because you really can't picture it. If you're here, you're, let's just say, in Evanston looking in Wilmette, you can always come back. I don't know that it's critical. I think curb appeal is less important now than it once was, because we have pre-shopped on the internet.
Oh.
And so I've probably already seen the picture of the pretty front porch with the tulips and the leafy branches arching over. So the fact that it's raining may not ruin it quite so much for me. And again, I can come back. I wouldn't say it's critical. It's probably something that could be adjusted pretty quickly.
About shopping online, though, I wonder what you feel about digital staging of homes.
You mean whether it should be done?
Yeah.
I think as long as it's labeled, I don't have a problem with it, because really looking at an empty, if the sellers have already moved out and you're looking at pictures of empty rooms, it's very hard to picture. So would a couch go over here or over there? I mean, I think it's I don't want to say a crutch. It's an aid you can provide buyers. It has to be labeled. I mean, that's required in any MLS or anything else. But I think anything you can do to help the person who's, you know, sitting on their couch at home flipping through these, which is how we shop for homes now. We really do probably 9/10 of our preliminary shopping. I don't want these. I do want these, and I'll go see them. We do it on the couch, and anything you can do to make it easier. I mean, I look at empty properties, and, you know, I look at properties all day, all week, and it's harder really to wrap my head around that property than the one that has a couch in it.
I am a little amazed sometimes when I see people's stuff and, you know, the garbage can has garbage in it, you can see, or
yeah,
the iron is just sitting there on the floor.
Can I say something to the entire real estate industry? Please put the toilet seat down before you take the picture. That drives me absolutely crazy. Just close the toilet seat. I look at houses all week, and an up toilet seat drives me nuts in a photo.
Mm.
Thank you for giving me that time.
Well, that pretty much wraps up our conversation with Dennis, because everything after that won't be as meaningful or powerful. I used to think more about the you can paint the walls digitally. You can lay carpeting digitally.
Yeah.
I guess ultimately the person's going to walk in and see it and realize, oh, I could put up a gray wall paint.
Yeah.
But this is just, you know, a flat white or something like that. But as long as you're labeling it as much, you're okay.
Yeah, you're not suggesting that when people get to the house, they're going to see those white walls. It's still going to be green.
Yeah, but I think you were. I think you were. I think that previously, it seems to me like, is it always very clear that this has been digitally staged?
I would say it's often very clear. It's supposed to be clear. Any real estate agency and the MLS will tell you it should be clear. And one thing that agents do that I think really works is they will show both sets. Here's how it looks as it is, and here's how it looks staged.
Sure, sure.
Which makes a lot of sense because, you know, for somebody who might be bugged by sometimes the couch, the furniture that they insert digitally might look a little off.
Uh-huh.
And also, you don't want to see the white walls because you've seen white walls in the other 100 listings you've looked at. I can see both. This is what it is. This is the raw palette, the raw material. And then here's a version of how it might be finished.
How have homes been selling in Chicago?
Very slowly. We are in September, which is the month we have the latest data for. There were fewer homes sold both in the city and in the metropolitan area than any September since 2011. And 2011 was when we were climbing out of that housing crash of 2007-2008. We were still really struggling in Chicago to get the market back on its feet, and that's the level we're selling at. Year to date, so that was September. Year to date, it's not as bad, it's at 2012 levels. But by the end of the year, if things stay as slow as they are, we will have had the slowest real estate market since 2011. And one of the reasons that matters is it's not just numbers on paper. It also, the thing that matters to me, I think, is, you know, when you buy a house, you also buy rugs and a couch and whatever else to put in that house. And so if we're seeing fewer homes sold than any time since 2011, 2012, then that secondary consumer spending on all those things that you bring into the house, that's also not happening.
So why are sales off?
Well, part of it right now is the uncertainty. I think a piece of it is that people have been waiting because we're in a presidential election where each side thinks that only its side can save the U.S. economy. The other side,
which doesn't need saving, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the other side, each side thinks the other side will tank the U.S. economy. So I just want to wait and see what's going to happen. Interest rates very likely will be affected by the person who wins. But larger than that, going on all year and really previously in previous years, is interest rates are now twice what they were for most of the 21st century. Since July 2022, well, really since spring 2022 when the Federal Reserve started jacking up interest rates. And in July of that year, they really hit the highest they had been in the 21st century and have remained high. We're in the 7% range. And most people who bought a house before 2022 had it in the 3% range.
Yep.
And so the cost of trading from the house I'm in with a 3% mortgage to another house with a 7% mortgage.
Sure.
And that is compounded by the fact that in Chicago, our prices continue to rise very fast. We, in the latest data, our home prices were up about 7% from the same time a year ago. That's faster growth than almost any major U.S. city.
But we were a lagger on that, right?
We were for years, yeah. And part
so
of the
we
reason
had more room to grow.
We did have more room to grow, and one of the reasons we continue to grow is that we didn't boom to the point of frothiness during the housing boom. Our prices went up, but they didn't go up the way they did in Austin and Boise and places like that. So we do have still have room to grow, but that doesn't mean that it's not harder for me to afford. You know, a house costs 7% more than it did a year ago, and interest rates remain high. So not only are people who don't want to trade the house because of the higher interest rates not putting it on the market, but I don't want to buy because the cost of buying is so expensive.
Elise Glink was on with us yesterday from Think Link Media, and she reminded us that the percentage of people who are buying homes with cash is 24%. One in four homes are bought with cash. That sounded high to me, maybe because I just can't get my head around that. But I mean, does that surprise you?
It doesn't. A lot of those purchases, it doesn't add up to one quarter of all purchases, but a lot of those purchases are at the upper end.
Yeah.
If I'm buying $1 million, $5 million, $10 million home, very likely I'm doing it with cash. During the years when interest rates were very low, I might have bought with a mortgage anyway because borrowing was so cheap. Now that it's not as cheap, I'm going ahead and buying it with my inheritance, my money out of the stock market, or whatever else, other reason I have a lot of cash and parking it in real estate.
Gold Coast Mansion is Chicago's highest priced home for sale. There's a Four Seasons condo out there and a Frank Lloyd home, the Winslow House. Frank Lloyd Wright's Winslow House has sold. Tell us these stories in a minute. We're talking to Dennis Rodkin. It's 1244. I'm getting all these words wrong. Your name's Rodkin, right?
It is today.
Is there such a thing as Rodkin? Dennis Rodkin is here, the residential real estate reporter. Let's stop me talking and get you another business update with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Guests at some Chicago hotels may soon have to pay an additional 1.5% surcharge that would help fund the activities of the city's promotional arm, Choose Chicago. It would encompass what's being called a tourism improvement district that would include hotels in Chicago's Central Business District with at least 100 rooms. It's hoped the plan would raise $50 million in new revenue to be used for tourism promotion. Cranes reports the new district would require approval of the city council and the blessing of the hotels involved to move forward. Analysts have said Choose Chicago needs more funding to adequately do its job. A criminal case brought by the U.S. Department of Justice involving former employees says Motorola Solutions was hacked by the Chinese military. The hacking reportedly occurred during the time Motorola was suing a Chinese competitor for mishandling trade secrets. According to DOJ, the hack happened back in 2017. About 1,000 documents were illegally accessed. The larger case involves Motorola employees who took thousands of Motorola documents covering the company's technology, including source code for software and handheld radios. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food. Now Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And let's begin with promises made on the campaign trail.
The largest deportation
in the history of our country.
History of the United States.
American history.
What that has to do with the business of food, after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. The campaign promises of mass deportations, millions of undocumented or illegal immigrants being rounded up, gets a lot of voters worked up on the campaign trail, but there's a problem.
The ag industry and our food security rely on approximately 2.4 million farm workers. Roughly half are undocumented and 10% or workers here on H-2A visas.
That's Arturo Rodriguez, the longtime leader of the United Farm Workers Union, speaking at a hearing about overhauling the H-2A visa program, an issue that's been plaguing agriculture for decades because Americans won't do the often difficult and dangerous and dirty work that immigrants will.
It was very hard to find employees willing to be at the farm at 4 in the morning to milk cows.
Linnea Kustra and her husband Joel milked cows for over 40 years near Woodstock, Illinois.
After switching to an immigrant workforce, our lives became much easier. Our people were loyal, dedicated workers. They were hardworking and they were honest.
That Senate hearing was in 2021, and still nothing has been done about H-2A. And Reuters reported over the weekend that almost 1.7 million undocumented immigrants work in the food supply chain. And under the Trump deportation plan, thousands of dairy farms would go out of business and milk would nearly double in price. So, fixing the H-2A program would seem to be a priority. But as noted at Durbin's hearing by Oregon asparagus farmer Shay Myers,
the last 36 years of policies and political failures have led us here. It's not economically viable, and it's not safe to kick this can down the road yet again.
But it was. In June of last year, a bipartisan bill to overhaul the visa program was reintroduced. It was referred to committee for a period to be determined by the Speaker of the House. And that is as far as it got. As Cubs fans say, there's always next year, or maybe not. On the food calendar, it's National Donut Day again. There are two each year.
Donuts.
I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Texts are pouring in for Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter over at Crane's Chicago Business. You know what they're about?
No. Toilet seats?
Yes.
Oh. Have I started a movement?
309. Yeah. Don't say movement.
Oh, sorry.
Yes to the toilet seat and lid being down. 630. I agree with Dennis about toilet seats. Ick. 2 exclamation points. 815. Amen. 2 exclamation points. Put down the toilet seat. 708. Yes. 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 Right on, Dennis. Toilet seats down.
I can't believe this, John. This has been
Oh, I can believe this.
So important to me because I've said this to real estate agents and now we've sent it all the way out all over the WGN territory.
Gold Coast Mansion is Chicago's highest priced home for sale. Tell me about it.
This is a remarkable place on Astor Street. It was once called the Court of the Golden Hand, later known as Astor Court. It is enormous. When you pass it, you would think you're passing an audit. Pardon me, an auditorium or something like that. It's nearly half a block long, and you can see that it's possible to drive in under through the building into an internal courtyard. Built in the 19-teens, designed by Howard Van Doren Shaw, who was an architect of many mansions, both in the city and Lake Forest and elsewhere, for the Goodman family, the parents of the namesake of the Goodman Theater. One old Chicago Tribune report says that is actually the house he died in, though other people believe he died in the house next door. Anyway, it's got a connection to these lumber barons. Since the 1980s, it's been owned by a man who, what he told me is, when I bought it, I should have been intimidated by the depth of the rehab it needed, but I wasn't. And he has done everything. This place is unbelievable. It's a 25,000 square foot house. It has within it 6 rental apartments. Those used to be the servants' quarters. I'm sorry, neither of us said. He's asking $21 million for this, which is the highest price in the region right now. Just came on the market last week.
Is he putting it up as a multi-unit rental facility?
He's putting it up as one property, and then you might put relatives in those rentals. He has had them rented out for years. He moved in, actually, as a renter in the mid-1980s when it was in the hands of the estate of the prior owners, wasn't yet for sale. Then he bought it, and that's when he says he should have been intimidated. This place is unbelievable. Again, you drive into this courtyard, and that's all landscaped with fountains, and you go inside, and it's so ornate. It's hard to believe. I think you've got the pictures there.
I do.
Beamed ceilings and paneling. I mean, it looks like a palace built in the 19-teens with endless money.
No, we just got back from England. We traveled to Europe once in a while. Every now and then we're walking through one of these chateaus or palaces. This looks like a European chateau with the marble inlay and the wood.
And that's what he said to me is when you see a house, this house is gigantic. And he said, when you see these in the countryside in England, in Paris, something like that, you're not as surprised. But this is very big, even for Chicago. This is very big for Chicago. It's also one of the few old Astor Street Gold Coast mansions still intact. Another big one was the Isham Mansion, which became the Playboy Mansion, divided up into condos. It was about the size of this, but it's all chopped up. There are others. The McCormick Mansion is condos. The only other mansion about this size would be the one Governor Pritzker bought back in about 2007, long before his political career. There are very few of this size still intact, and there's nothing of this opulence.
Well, the guy that lives there now, so has it sold or is it selling?
It's for sale. He put it on the market Friday at $21 million.
How did this guy get $20 million?
He didn't buy it for $21 million. He's an attorney.
Okay, but still, so he bought it for whatever.
Bought it in the 1980s.
And then had to bring it up. I mean, he's...
And invested over time, right?
Wow. The billiards room looks like something out of a storybook.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. You know, he would have got more, but look at this picture. The toilet seat is up.
The toilet seat is up.
And had that been down, that property
would have... And knocked that price down from $21 million to $15 just for the toilet seats.
I ain't buying it with that toilet up. All right. We're out of time. Look at the pictures of these at chicagobusiness.com. Dennis Rodkin is the residential real estate reporter over at Crane's Chicago Business. Nice to see you.
Thanks, John.